further sign. Holden only moved off down the hall. When he was out of earshot, Alex sighed. Trouble? Prax asked.
Yeah. Don't worry. It's not about you. This has been brewing for a while now.
I'm sorry, Prax said.
Had to happen. Best to get it over with, one way or the other,
Alex said. But there was an unmistakable dread in his voice. Prax felt himself liking the man. The wall terminal chirped, and then spoke in Amos's voice.
What have you got now?
Alex pulled the terminal close, the articulated arm bending and twisting on complicated joints, then tapped on it with the fingers of one hand while keeping hold of the coffee with the other. The terminal flickered, datasets converting to graphs and tables in real time.
10%, Alex said. No, 12. We're moving up. What'd you find?
Cracked seal, Amos said.
And yeah, you're very fucking clever. What else we got?
Alex tapped on the terminal, and Holden reappeared from the hallway, now without his case.
Port sensor array took a hit. Looks like we burned out a few of the leads, Alex said.
All right, Amos said. Let's get those bad boys swapped out.
Or maybe we can do something that doesn't involve crawling on the outside of the ship under thrust, Holden said.
I can get it done, Cap, Amos said.
Even through the tinny wall speaker, he sounded affronted. Holden shook his head.
One slip and the exhaust cooks you down to component atoms. Let's leave that for the techs on Tycho.
Alex, what else have we got?
Memory leak in the navigation system. Probably a fried network that grew back wrong, the pilot said. The cargo bay is still in vacuum. The radio array's as dead as a hammer for no apparent reason. Hand terminals aren't talking. And one of the medical pods is throwing error codes, so don't get sick.
Holden went to the coffee machine, talking over his shoulder as he keyed in his preferences. His cup said Tachi, too. Prax realized with a start that they all did. He wondered who or what a Tachi was.
Does the cargo bay need EVA?
Don't know, Alex said. Let me take a look.
Holden took his coffee mug out of the machine with a little sigh and stroked the brushed metal plates like he was petting a cat. On impulse, Prax cleared his throat.
Excuse me, he said. Captain Holden, I was wondering if the radio gets fixed or there's a tight beam available, if maybe there's a way I could use some time on the communications array.
We're kind of trying to be quiet right now, Holden said. What are you wanting to send?
I need to do some research, Prax said. The data we got on Ganymede from when they took May. There are images of the woman who was with them. And if I can find what happened to Dr. Strickland, I've been on a security locked system since the day she went missing. Even if it was just the public access databases and networks, it would be a place to start.
And it's that, or sit around and stew until we get to Tycho, Holden said. All right, I'll ask Naomi to get you an access account for the ROSI's network. I don't know if there'll be anything in the OPA files, but you might as well check them too.
Really?
Sure, Holden said. They've got a pretty decent face recognition database. It's inside their secure perimeters, so you might need to have one of us make the request.
And that would be all right? I don't want to get you in trouble with the OPA.
Holden's smile was warm and cheerful.
Really, don't worry about that, he said. Alex, what have we got?
Looks like cargo door's not sealing, which we knew. We may have taken a hit, blown a hole in her. We've got the video feed back up. Hold on.
Holden shifted to peer over Alex's shoulder. Prax took another swallow of his food and gave in to curiosity. An image of a cargo bay, no wider than Prax's palm, took up one corner of the display. Most of the cargo was on electromagnetic pallets, stuck to the plates nearest the wide bay door, but some had broken loose, pressed by thrust gravity to the floor. It gave the room an unreal, Escher-like appearance. Alex resized the image, zooming in on the cargo door. In one corner, a thick section of metal was bent inward, bright metal showing where the bend had cracked the external layers. A spray of stars showed through the hole.
Well, at least it ain't subtle, Alex said.
What hit it? Holden said.
Don't know, Cap, Alex said. No scorching as far as I can see. But a Gauss round wouldn't have bent the metal in like that. Just would have made a hole. And the bay isn't breached, so whatever did it didn't make a hole on the other side.
The pilot increased the magnification again, looking closely at the edges of the wound. It was true there were no scorch marks, but thin, black smudges showed against the metal of the door and the deck. Prax frowned. He opened his mouth to speak, then closed it again. Holden said what Prax had been thinking.
Alex, is that a handprint?
Looks like one, Cap, but
pull out. Look at the decking. They were small, subtle, easy to overlook on the small image, but they were there. A handprint, smeared in something dark that Prax had the strong suspicion had once been red. The unmistakable print of five naked toes. A long smear of darkness. The pilot followed the trail.
That bay's in hard vacuum, right?
Holden asked.
Has been for a day and a half, sir,
Alex said. The casual air was gone. They were all business now.
Track right, Holden said.
Yes, sir.
Okay, stop. What's that?
The body was curled into a fetal ball, except where its palms were pressed against the bulkhead. It lay perfectly still, as if they were under high G and it was held against the deck, crushed by its own weight. The flesh was the black of anthracite and the red of blood. Prax couldn't tell if it had been a man or a woman.
Alex, do we have a stowaway? Pretty sure that ain't on the cargo manifest, sir. And did that fellow there bend his way through my ship with his bare hands?
Looks like maybe, sir.
Amos? Naomi?
I'm looking at it too.
Naomi's voice came from the terminal a moment before Amos's low whistle. Prax thought back to the mysterious sounds of violence in the lab. The bodies of guards they hadn't fought. The shattered glass and its black filament. Here was the experiment that had slipped its leash back at that lab. It had fled to the cold, dead surface of Ganymede and waited there until a chance came to escape. Prax felt the goose flesh crawling up his arms.
Okay, Holden said.
But it's dead, right?
I don't think so, Naomi said.
Chapter 25. Bobby. Bobby's hand terminal began playing reveille at 4:30 a.m. local time. What she and her mates might have grumbled and called "Oh, Dark 30" back when she'd been a Marine and had mates to grumble with. She'd left her terminal in the living room, lying next to the pull-down cot she used as a bed, the volume set high enough to have left her ears ringing if she'd been in there with it. But Bobby had already been up for an hour. In her cramped bathroom, the sound was only annoying, bouncing around her tiny apartment like radio in a deep well. The echoes were a sonic reminder that she still didn't have much furniture or any wall hangings. It didn't matter. She'd never had a guest. The reveille was a mean-spirited little joke Bobby was playing on herself. The Martian military had formed hundreds of years after trumpets and drums had been a useful means of transmitting information to troops. Martians lacked the nostalgia the UN military had for such things. The first time Bobby had heard a morning reveille, she'd been watching a video on military history. She'd been happy to realize that no matter how annoying the Martian equivalent, a series of atonal electronic blats, was, it would never be as annoying as what the Earth boys woke up to. But now Bobby wasn't a Martian Marine anymore. "I'm not a traitor," Bobby said to her reflection in the mirror. Mirror Bobby looked unconvinced. After the blaring trumpet call's third repetition, her hand terminal beeped once and fell into a sullen silence. She'd been holding her toothbrush for the last half hour. The toothpaste had started to grow a hard skin. She ran it under warm water to soften it back up and started brushing her teeth. "I'm not a traitor," she said to herself, the toothbrush making the words unintelligible. "Not. Not even standing here in the bathroom of her UN-provided apartment, brushing her teeth with UN toothpaste and rinsing the sink with UN-provided water. Not while she clutched her good Martian toothbrush and scrubbed until her gums bled. Not," she said again, daring Mirror Bobby to disagree. She put the toothbrush back into her small toiletry case, carried it into the living room, and placed it in her duffel. Everything she owned stayed in the duffel. She'd need to move fast when her people called her home. And they would. She'd get a priority dispatch on her terminal, the red and gray border of the MCRN syncom flashing around it. They'd tell her that she needed to return to her unit immediately, that she was still one of them, that she wasn't a traitor for staying. She straightened her uniform, slid her now quiet terminal into her pocket, and checked her hair in the mirror next to the door. It was pulled into a bun so tight it almost gave her a facelift, not one single hair out of place. "I'm not a traitor," she said to the mirror. Front hallway Mirror Bobby seemed more open to this idea than bathroom Mirror Bobby had. "Damn straight," she said, then slammed the door behind her when she left. She hopped on one of the little electric bikes the UN campus made available everywhere and was in the office 3 minutes before 5 a.m. Sorin was already there. No matter what time she came in, Sorin always beat her. Either he slept at his desk, or he was spying on her to see what time she set her alarm for each morning. "Bobby," he said, his smile not even pretending to be genuine. Bobby couldn't bring herself to respond, so she just nodded and collapsed into her chair. One glance at the darkened windows in Avasarala's office told her the old lady wasn't in yet. Bobby pulled up her to-do list on the desktop screen. "She had me add a lot of people," Sorin said, referring to the list of people Bobby was supposed to call in her role as Martian military liaison. "She really wants to get a hold of an early draft of the Martian statement on Ganymede. That's your top priority for the day, okay?" "Why?" Bobby said. "The actual statement came out yesterday. We both read it." "Bobby," Sorin said, with a sigh that said he was tired of explaining simple things to her, but a grin that said he really wasn't. "This is how the game is played. Mars releases a statement condemning our actions. We go back channel and find an early draft. If it was harsher than the actual statement that was released, then someone in the Dip Corps argued to tone it down. That means they're trying to avoid escalating. If it was milder in the early draft, then they're deliberately escalating to provoke a response." "But since they know you'll get those early drafts, then that's meaningless. They'll just make sure you get leaks that give you the impression they want you to have." "See? Now you're getting it," Sorin said. What your opponent wants you to think is useful data in figuring out what they think. So, get the early draft, okay? Do it before the end of the day.
But no one talks to me anymore because now I'm the UN's pet Martian. And even though I'm not a traitor, it is entirely possible that everyone else thinks I am, Bobby thought.
Okay. Bobby pulled up the newly revised list and made the first connection request of the day.
Bobby!
Avasarala yelled from her desk. There was any number of electronic means for getting Bobby's attention, but she almost never saw Avasarala use them. She yanked her earbud free and stood up. Soren's smirk was of the psychic variety. His face didn't change at all.
Ma'am? Bobby said, taking a short step into Avasarala's office. You bellowed?
No one likes a smartass,
Avasarala said, not looking up from her desk terminal.
Where's my first draft of that report? It's almost lunchtime.
Bobby stood a little straighter and clasped her arms behind her back.
Sir, I regret to inform you that I have been unable to find anyone willing to release the early draft of the report to me.
Are you standing at attention? Avasarala said, looking up at her for the first time.
Jesus, I'm not about to march you out to the firing squad. Did you try everyone on the list?
Yes, I...
Bobby stopped for a moment and took a deep breath, then took a few more steps into the office. Quietly, she said,
No one talks to me.
The old woman lifted a snow-white eyebrow.
That's interesting.
Is it?
Bobby said. Avasarala smiled at her, a warm, genuine smile, then poured tea out of a black iron pot into two small teacups. Sit down, she said, waving at a chair next to her desk. When Bobby remained standing, Avasarala said,
Seriously, sit the fuck down. 5 minutes talking to you and I can't tilt my head forward again for an hour.
Bobby sat, hesitated, and took one of the small teacups. It wasn't much larger than a shot glass, and the tea inside it was very dark and smelled unpleasant. She took a small sip and burned her tongue.
It's a Lapsang Souchong, Avasarala said. My husband buys it for me. What do you think?
I think it smells like hobo feet, Bobby replied.
No shit, but Arjun loves it. And it's not bad once you get used to drinking it.
Bobby nodded and took another sip, but didn't reply.
Okay, so, Avasarala said, you're the Martian who was unhappy and got tempted over to the other side by a powerful old lady with lots of shiny prizes to offer. You're the worst kind of traitor, because ultimately everything that's happened to you since you came to Earth was because you were pouting.
Shut the fuck up now, dear, the grown-up is talking. Bobby shut up and drank her awful tea.
But,
Avasarala continued, the same sweet smile on her wrinkled face,
if I were on the other team, you know who I'd send misinformation leaks to?
Me. Bobby said,
You, because you're desperate to prove your value to your new boss. And they can send you blatantly false information and not really care if they fuck your shit up in the long run. If I were the Martian counter-espionage wonks, I'd have already recruited one of your closest friends back home and be using them to funnel a mountain's worth of false data your direction.
My closest friends are all dead, Bobby thought.
But no one is talking to you from back home, which means two things. They are still trying to figure out my game in keeping you here, and they don't have a misinformation campaign in place because they're as confused as we are. You'll be contacted by someone in the next week or so. They'll ask you to leak information from my office, but they'll ask it in such a way that winds up giving you a whole lot of false information. If you're loyal and spy for them, great. If not, and you tell me what they asked for, also great. Maybe they'll get lucky, and you'll do both.
Bobby put the teacup back on the desk. Her hands were in fists.
This, Bobby said, is why everyone hates politicians.
No, they hate us because we have power.
Bobby, this isn't how your mind likes to work, and I respect that.
I don't have time to explain things to you,
Avasarala said, the smile disappearing like it had never been. So just assume I know what I'm doing, and that when I ask you to do the impossible, it's because even your failure helps our cause somehow.
Our cause?
We're on the same team here. Team, let's not lose together. That is us, isn't it?
Yes, Bobby said, glancing at the Buddha in his shrine.
Just one of the team, his round face seemed to say.
Yes, it is.
Then get the fuck back out there and start calling everyone all over again. This time, take detailed notes on who refuses to help you and the exact words they use in their refusal. Okay?
Solid copy on that, ma'am.
Good, Avasarala said, smiling gently again. Get out of my office.
Familiarity might breed contempt, but Bobby hadn't much liked Soren right from the start. Sitting next to him for several days had ratcheted up her dislike to a whole new level. When he wasn't ignoring her, he was condescending. He talked too loud in his phone, even when she was trying to carry on a conversation of her own. Sometimes he sat on her desk, talking to visitors. He wore too much cologne. The worst thing was he ate cookies all day. It was impressive, given his rail-thin build, and Bobby was not generally the kind of person who cared at all about other people's dietary habits, but his preferred brand of cookie came out of the break room vending machine in a foil packet that crinkled every time he reached into it. At first, this had only been annoying. But after a couple of days of the crinkle, crunch, chomp, and smack radio theater, she'd had enough. She dropped her latest pointless connection and turned to stare at him. He ignored her and tapped on his desk terminal.
Soren, she said, meaning to ask him to dump the damn cookies out on a plate or a napkin so she didn't have to hear that infuriating crinkle sound anymore. Before she could get more than his name out, he held up a finger to shush her and pointed at his earbud.
No, he said. Not really a good...
Bobby wasn't sure if he was talking to her or someone on the phone, so she got up and moved over to his desk, sitting on the edge of it. He gave her a withering glare, but she just smiled and mouthed, "I'll wait." The edge of his desk creaked a little under her weight. He turned his back to her.
I understand, he said, but this is not a good time to discuss.
I see. I can probably...
I see, yes. Foster won't...
Yes. Yes, I understand.
I'll be there.
He turned back around and tapped his desk, killing the connection.
What? I hate your cookies. The constant crinkle of the package is driving me insane.
Cookies? Soren said, a baffled expression on his face. Bobby thought that it might be the first honest emotion she'd ever seen there.
Yeah, can you put them on a... Bobby started, but before she could finish, Soren grabbed up the package and tossed them into the recycling bin next to his desk.
Happy?
Well, I don't have time for you right now, Sergeant.
Okay, Bobby said, and went back to her desk.
Soren kept fidgeting like he had more to say, so Bobby didn't call the next person on her list. She waited for him to speak. Probably the cookie thing had been a mistake on her part. Really, it wasn't a big deal. If she weren't under so much pressure, it wasn't the sort of thing she'd probably even notice. When Soren finally spoke up, she'd apologize for being so pushy about it, and then offer to buy him a new package. Instead of speaking, he stood up. Soren, I... Bobby started, but Soren ignored her and unlocked a drawer in his desk. He pulled out a small bit of black plastic. Probably because she'd just heard him say the name Foster, Bobby recognized it as the memory stick Avasarala had given him a few days earlier. Foster was the data services guy, so she assumed he was finally getting around to taking care of that little task, which would at least get him away from the office for a few minutes. Until he turned and headed for the elevators. Bobby had done a little gopher work, running things back and forth to data services, and knew that their office was on the same floor and in the opposite direction of the elevators. Huh. She was tired. She was half sick with guilt, and she wasn't even all that sure what she felt guilty about. She disliked the man anyway. The hunch that popped into her head was almost certainly a result of her own paranoia and addled image of the world. She got up, following him. This is really stupid, she said to herself, smiling and nodding at a page who hurried by. She was over 2 meters tall on a planet of short people. She wasn't going to blend. Soren climbed into an elevator. Bobby stopped outside the doors and waited. Through the aluminum and ceramic doors, she heard him ask someone to press one. Going all the way to the street level, then. She hit the down button and took the next elevator to the bottom floor. A giant Martian woman running around the lobby of the UN building would draw a little attention, so she scrapped that as a plan. A wave of uncertainty, failure, and despair lapped at the shoreline of her mind. Forget that it was an office building. Forget that there were no armed enemy, no squad behind her. Forget that and look at the logic of the situation on the ground. Think tactically. Be smart. I need to be smart, she said. A short woman in a red suit who had just come up and pressed the elevator call button overheard her and said, What? I need to be smart, Bobby told her. Can't go running off half-cocked. Not even when doing something insane and stupid, she thought. I see, the woman said, then pushed the elevator call button again several times. Next to the elevator control panel was a courtesy terminal. If you can't find the target, restrict the target's degrees of freedom. Make them come to you. Right. Bobby hit the button for the lobby reception desk. An automated system with an extremely realistic and sexually ambiguous voice asked how it could assist her. Please page Soren Cotwald to the lobby reception desk, Bobby said. The computer on the other end of the line thanked her for using the UN automated courtesy system and dropped the connection. Soren might not have his terminal on, or it could be set to ignore incoming pages, or he might ignore this one all on his own. She found a couch with a sightline to the desk and shifted to ficus to provide her cover. 2 minutes later, Soren trotted up to the reception desk, his hair more windblown than usual. He must have already been all the way outside when he got the page. He began talking to one of the human receptionists. Bobby moved across the lobby to a little coffee and snack kiosk and hid as best she could. After typing on her desk for a moment, the receptionist pointed at the terminal next to the elevators. Soren frowned and took a few steps toward it, then looked around nervously and headed toward the building entrance. Bobby followed. Once Bobby was outside, her height was both an advantage and a disadvantage. Being a head and a half taller than most everyone around her meant that she could afford to stay pretty far behind Soren as he hurried along the sidewalk. She could spot the top of his head from half a city block away. At the same time, if he looked behind him, He couldn't miss her face sticking up a good third of a meter out of the crowd. But he didn't turn around. In fact, he appeared to be in something of a hurry, pushing his way through the knots of people on the busy sidewalks around the UN campus with obvious impatience. He didn't look around, or pause by a good reflective surface, or backtrack. He'd been nervous answering the page, and he was being pointedly, angrily, not nervous now. Whistling past the graveyard, Bobby felt her muscles soften, her joints grow loose and easy, her hunch slip a centimeter closer to certainty. After three blocks, he turned and went into a bar. Bobby stopped a half block away and considered. The front of the bar, a place creatively named Pete's, was darkened glass. If you wanted to duck in somewhere and see if people were following you, it was the perfect place to go. Maybe he'd gotten smart. Maybe he hadn't. Bobby walked over to the front door. Getting caught following him had no consequences. Soren already hated her. The most ethically suspect thing she was doing was cutting out early to pop into a neighborhood bar. Who was going to rat on her? Soren? The guy who cut out just as early and went to the same damn bar? If he was in there, and doing nothing more than grabbing an early beer, she'd just walk up to him, apologize for the cookie thing, and buy him his second round. She pushed the door open and went inside. It took her eyes a moment to adjust from the early afternoon sunlight outside to the dimly lit bar. Once the glare had faded, she saw a long bamboo bar top manned by a human bartender, half a dozen booths with about as many patrons, and no Soren. The air smelled of beer and burnt popcorn. The patrons gave her one look, and then carefully went back to their drinks and mumbled conversations. Had Soren ducked out the back to ditch her? She didn't think he'd seen her, but she wasn't exactly trained for tailing people. She was about to ask the bartender if he'd seen a guy run through and where that guy might have gone, when she noticed a sign at the back of the bar that said, "Pool tables," with an arrow pointing left. She walked to the back of the bar, turned left, and found a smaller second room with four pool tables and two men. One of them was Soren. They both looked up as she turned the corner. "Hi," she said. Soren was smiling at her, but he was always smiling. Smiling for him was protective coloration, camouflage. The other man was large, fit, and wearing an excessively casual outfit that tried too hard to look like it belonged in a seedy pool hall. It clashed with the man's military haircut and ramrod straight posture. Bobby had a feeling she'd seen his face before, but in a different setting. She tried to picture him with a uniform on. "Bobby?" Soren said, giving his companion one quick glance and then looking away. "You play?" He picked up a pool cue that had been lying on one of the tables and began chalking the tip. Bobby didn't point out that there were no balls on any of the tables, and that a sign just behind Soren said, "Rental balls available on request." His companion said nothing, but slid something into his pocket. Between his fingers, Bobby caught a glimpse of black plastic. She smiled. She knew where she'd seen the second man before. "No," she said to Soren. "It's not popular where I come from." "Slate, I guess," he replied. His smile became a bit more genuine and a lot colder. He blew the chalk dust off the pool cue's tip and moved a step to the side, shifting toward her left. "Too heavy for the early colony ships." "Makes sense," Bobby said, moving back until the doorway protected her flanks. "Is this a problem?" Soren's companion said, looking at Bobby. Before Soren could reply, Bobby said, You tell me. You were at that late-night meeting in Avasarala's office when Ganymede went to shit. Nguyen's staff, right? Lieutenant something or other. You're digging a hole, Bobby, Soren said. The pool cue held lightly in his right hand. And, she continued, I know Soren handed you something his boss had asked him to take to data services a couple days ago. I bet you don't work in data services, do you? Nguyen's flunky took a menacing step toward her, and Soren shifted to her left again. Bobby burst out laughing. Seriously? She said, looking at Soren. Either stop jerking that pool cue off or take it somewhere private. Soren looked down at the cue in his hand as though surprised to see it there, then dropped it. And you, Bobby said to the flunky. You trying to come through this door would literally be the high point of my month. Without moving her feet, she shifted her weight forward and flexed her elbows slightly. The flunky looked her in the eye for one long moment. She grinned back. Come on, she said. I'm gonna get blue balls, you keep teasing me like this. The flunky put up his hands. Something halfway between a fighting stance and a gesture of surrender. Never taking his eyes off Bobby, he turned his face slightly toward Soren and said, This is your problem. Handle it. He backed up two slow steps, then turned and walked across the room and into a hallway Bobby couldn't see from where she was standing. A second later, she heard a door slam. Shit. Bobby said. I bet I'd have scored more points with the old lady if I'd gotten that memory stick back. Soren began to shuffle toward the back door. Bobby crossed the space between them like a cat, grabbing the front of his shirt and pulling him up until their noses were almost touching. Her body felt alive and free, for the first time in a long time. What are you going to do? He said through a forced smirk. Beats me up? No, Bobby replied, shifting to an exaggerated Mariner Valley drawl. I'm gonna tell on you, boy. Chapter 26 Holden. Holden watched the monster quiver as it huddled against the cargo bay bulkhead. On the video monitor, it looked small and washed out and grainy. He concentrated on his breathing. Long, slow breath in. Fill up the lungs all the way to the bottom. Long, slow breath out. Pause. Repeat. Do not lose your shit in front of the crew. Well, Alex said after a minute, there's your problem. He was trying to make a joke. Had made a joke. Normally, Holden would have laughed at his exaggerated drawl and comic obviousness. Alex could be very funny in a dry, understated sort of way. Right now, Holden had to clench his hands to stop from strangling the man. Amos said, I'm coming up, at the same moment Naomi said, I'm coming down. Alex, Holden said, pretending a calm he didn't feel. What's the status of the cargo bay airlock? Alex tapped twice on the terminal and said, Airtight, Cap. Zero loss. Which was good, because as frightened of the protomolecule as he was, Holden also knew that it wasn't magic. It had mass, and it occupied space. If not even a molecule of oxygen could sneak out through the airlock seal, then he was pretty sure none of the virus could get in. But, Alex, crank up the O2, Holden said, as rich as we can get it without blowing the ship up. The protomolecule was anaerobic. If any of it did somehow get in, he wanted the environment as hostile as possible. And get up to the cockpit, he continued. Seal yourself in. If the goo somehow gets loose on the ship, I need your finger on the reactor overrides. Alex frowned and scratched his thin hair.
That seems a little extreme.
Holden grabbed him by the upper arms, hard. Alex's eyes went wide and his hands came up in an automatic gesture of surrender. Beside him, the botanist blinked in confusion and alarm. This was not the best way to instill confidence. In other circumstances, Holden might have cared.
Alex, Holden said, not able to stop himself from shaking even while clutching the pilot's arms.
Can I count on you to blow this ship into gas if that shit gets in here?
Because if I can't, consider yourself relieved of duty and confined to quarters immediately.
Alex surprised him, not by reacting in anger, but by reaching up and putting his hands on Holden's forearms. Alex's face was serious, but his eyes were kind.
Seal myself into the cockpit and prepare to scuttle the ship.
Aye, aye, sir, he said.
What's the stand-down order?
Direct order from myself or Naomi, Holden replied with a hidden sigh of relief. He didn't have to say, if that thing gets in here and kills us, you're better off going up with the ship.
He let go of Alex's arms, and the pilot took one step back, his broad, dark face wrinkled with concern. The panic that threatened to overwhelm Holden might get out of his control if he allowed anyone to feel sympathy for him, so he said,
Now, Alex, do it now.
Alex nodded once, looked like he wanted to say something else, then spun on his heel and went to the crew ladder and up toward the cockpit. Naomi descended the same ladder a few moments later, and Amos came up from below a short time after that. Naomi spoke first.
What's the plan?
They'd been intimate long enough for Holden to recognize the barely concealed fear in her voice. Holden paused to take two more long breaths.
Amos and I will go see if we can't drive it out the cargo bay doors. Get them open for us.
Done, she said, and headed up the ladder to ops. Amos was watching him, a speculative look in his eyes.
So, Cap, how do we drive it out those doors?
Well, Holden replied, I was thinking we shoot the shit out of it, and then take a flamethrower to any pieces that fall off. So we better gear up.
Amos nodded.
Damn, I feel like I just took that shit off.
Holden was not claustrophobic. No one who chose long-flight space travel as a career was. Even if a person could somehow calm their way past the psychological profiles and simulation runs, one trip was usually enough to separate those who could handle long periods in confined spaces from those who went bugfuck and had to be sedated for the trip home. As a junior lieutenant, Holden had spent days in scout ships so small that you literally could not bend over to scratch your feet. He'd climbed around between the inner and outer hulls of warships. He'd once been confined to his crash couch for 21 days during a fast burn trip from Luna to Saturn. He never had nightmares of being crushed or being buried alive. For the first time in his decade and a half of nearly constant space travel, the ship he was on felt too small. Not just cramped, but terrifyingly constricted. He felt trapped, like an animal in a snare. Less than 12 meters away from where he stood, someone infected with the protomolecule was sitting in his cargo bay, and there was nowhere he could go to get away from it. Putting on his body armor didn't help this feeling of confinement. The first thing that went on was what the grunts called the full-body condom. It was a thick, black bodysuit made of multiple layers of Kevlar, rubber, impact-reactive gel, and the sensor network that kept track of his injury and vital status. Over that went the slightly looser environment suit, with its own layers of self-sealing gel to instantly repair tears or bullet holes, and finally, the various pieces of strap-on armor plating that could deflect a high-velocity rifle shot or ablate the outer layers to shed the energy of a laser. To Holden, it felt like wrapping himself in his own death shroud. But even with all its layers and weight, it still wasn't as frightening as the powered armor that recon Marines wore would have been, what the Navy boys called walking coffins. The idea behind the name being that anything powerful enough to break the armor would liquefy the Marine inside, so you didn't bother to open it. You just toss the whole thing into the grave. This was hyperbole, of course, but the idea of going into that cargo bay, wearing something that he wouldn't even be able to move without the power-enhanced strength, would have scared the shit out of him. What if the batteries died? Of course, a nice suit of strength-augmenting armor might be handy when trying to throw monsters off the ship.
"That's on backward," Amos said, pointing at Holden's thigh.
"Shit," Holden said. Amos was right. He'd been so far up his own ass that he'd screwed up the buckles on his thigh armor.
"Sorry, I'm having a hard time staying focused here."
"Scared shitless," Amos said with a nod.
"Well, I wouldn't say. Wasn't talking about you," Amos said.
"Me?
I'm scared shitless of walking into the cargo bay with that thing in there. And I didn't watch Eros turn into goo at close range. So I get it. Right there with you, Jim."
It was the first time in Holden's memory that Amos had called him by his first name. Holden nodded back at him, then went about straightening out his thigh armor.
"Yeah," he said. "I just yelled at Alex for not being scared enough."
Amos had finished with his armor and was pulling his favorite auto shotgun out of his locker.
"No shit."
"Yeah.
He made a joke, and I'm scared out of my skull, so I yelled at him and threatened to relieve him."
"Can you do that?" Amos asked. "He's kind of our only pilot."
"No, Amos. No, I can't kick Alex off the ship any more than I can kick you or Naomi off the ship.
We're not even a skeleton crew. We're whatever you have when you don't have a skeleton."
"Worried about Naomi leaving?" Amos said.
He kept his voice light, but his words hit like hammer blows. Holden felt the air go out of him and had to focus on breathing again for a minute.
"No," he said. "I mean, yes, of course I am, but that's not what has me freaked out right now."
Holden picked up his assault rifle and looked at it, then put it back in his locker and took out a heavy recoilless pistol instead. The self-contained rockets that were its ammunition wouldn't impart thrust and send him flying all over the place if he fired it in zero G.
"I watched you die," he said, not looking at Amos.
"Huh?"
"I watched you die. When that kidnap team, whoever the hell they were, took us. I saw one of them shoot you in the back of the head. And I saw you drop face first on the floor. There was blood everywhere."
"Yeah, but I know it was a non-lethal round. I know they wanted us alive. I know the blood was your broken nose when your head slammed into the floor. I know all of that now. At the time, what I knew was that you'd just been shot in the head and killed."
Amos slid a magazine into his shotgun and racked around, but other than that, didn't make a sound.
"All of this is really fragile," Holden said, waving around at Amos and the ship. "This little family we have. One fuck up and something irreplaceable gets lost."
Amos was frowning at him now.
"This is still about Naomi, right?"
"No. I mean, yes, but no. When I thought you were dead, it knocked all the wind out of me. And right now, I need to focus on getting that thing off the ship, and all I can think about is losing one of the crew."
Amos nodded, slung the shotgun over his shoulder, and sat down on the bench next to his locker.
"I get it. So, what do you want to do?"
"I want," Holden said, sliding a magazine into his pistol, "to get that fucking monster off my ship. But please promise me you won't die doing it. That would help a lot."
"Cap," Amos said with a grin, Anything that kills me has already killed everyone else. I was born to be the last man standing. You can count on it.
The panic and fear didn't leave Holden. They squatted on his chest now, just the way they had before. But at least he didn't feel so alone with them.
Then let's go get rid of this stowaway.
The wait inside the cargo bay airlock was endless as the inner door sealed, the pump sucked all the air out of the room, and then the outer door cycled open. Holden fidgeted and rechecked his gun half a dozen times while he waited. Amos stood in a relaxed slump, his huge shotgun cradled loosely in his arms. The upside, if there was an upside to the wait, was that with the cargo bay in vacuum, the airlock could make as much noise as it wanted without alerting the creature to their presence. The last of the external noise disappeared, and Holden could hear only himself breathing. A yellow light came on near the outer airlock door, warning them of the null atmosphere on the other side.
"Alex," Holden said, plugging a hard line into the airlock terminal.
Radio was still dead all over the ship.
"We're about to go in. Kill the engines."
"Roger that,"
Alex replied, and the gravity dropped away. Holden kicked the slide controls on his heels to turn up his magnetic boots. The cargo bay on the Rocinante was cramped. Tall and narrow, it occupied the starboard side of the ship, crammed into the unused space between the outer hull and the engineering bay. On the port side, the same space was filled with the ship's water tank. The Rossi was a warship. Any cargo it carried would be an afterthought. The downside to this was that while under thrust, the cargo bay turned into a well with the cargo doors at the bottom. The various crates that occupied the space latched onto mounts on the bulkheads, or in some cases were attached with electromagnetic feet. With thrust gravity threatening to send a person tumbling 7 meters straight down to the cargo doors, it would be an impossible place to fight effectively. In microgravity, it became a long hallway with lots of cover. Holden entered the room first, walking along the bulkhead on magnetic boots, and took cover behind a large metal crate filled with extra rounds for the ship's point defense cannons. Amos followed, taking up a position behind another crate 2 meters away. Below them, the monster seemed to be asleep. It huddled motionless against the bulkhead that separated the cargo bay from engineering.
"Okay, Naomi, go ahead and open it up," Holden said.
He jiggled the trailing line of cable to get it unhooked from a corner of the crate and gave it a little slack.
"Door's opening now," she replied, her voice thin and fuzzy in his helmet.
The cargo doors at the bottom of the room silently swung open, exposing several square meters of star-filled blackness. The monster either didn't notice the doors opening, or didn't care.
"They hibernate sometimes, right?"
Amos said, the cable running from his suit to the airlock looking like a high-tech umbilical cord.
"Like Julie did when she got the bug. Hibernated in that hotel room on Eros for a couple weeks."
"Maybe," Holden replied.
"How do you want to approach this? I'm almost thinking we should just go down there, grab the thing, and toss it out the door. But I have strong reservations about touching it."
"Yeah, wouldn't want to take our suits back inside with us," Amos agreed.
Holden had a sudden memory of coming in after playing outside and taking all his clothes off in the mudroom before Mother Tamara would let him into the rest of the house. This would be pretty much the same, only a lot colder.
"I find myself wishing we had a really long stick," Holden said, looking around at the various objects stored in the cargo bay, hoping to find one that suited his need.
Captain, Amos said, "it's looking at us."
Holden turned back around and saw Amos was right. The creature hadn't moved anything but its head, but it was definitely staring up at them now, its eyes a creepy, illuminated from within blue.
Well, okay, Holden said. It's not hibernating. You know, if I can knock it off that bulkhead with a shot or two and Alex kicks on the engine, it might just tumble right out the back door and into the exhaust plume. That ought to take care of it.
Let's think about, Holden said, but before he could finish his thought, the room strobed several times with the muzzle flash of Amos's shotgun. The monster was hit multiple times and knocked into a spinning lump floating toward the door.
Alex, just, Amos said.
The monster blurred into action. It flung one arm toward the bulkhead, the limb actually seeming to get longer to reach it, and yanked down hard enough to bend the steel plates. The creature hurtled up to the top of the cargo bay so fast that when it hit the crate Holden was hiding behind, the magnetic feet lost their seal. The cargo bay seemed to spin as the impact threw Holden back. The crate, just behind him, matched his velocity. Holden slammed against the bulkhead a split second before the crate did, and the magnetic pallet snapped onto the new wall, trapping Holden's leg beneath it. Something in his knee bent badly, and the pain turned the world red for a moment. Amos began firing his gun into the monster at close range, but it casually backhanded him and threw him into the cargo airlock hard enough to bend the inner door. The outer door slammed shut the second the inner door was compromised. Holden tried to move, but his leg was pinned by the crate, and with electromagnets rated to hold a quarter ton of weight under a 10G burn, he wouldn't be moving it anytime soon. The crate controls that would shut the magnets off showed the orange glow of a full seal 10 centimeters beyond his reach. The monster turned back to look at him. Its blue eyes were far too large for its head, giving the creature a curious, childlike look. It reached out one oversized hand. Holden fired into it until his gun was empty. The miniature, self-contained rockets the recoilless gun used as ammunition exploded in tiny puffs of light and smoke as they hit the creature, each one pushing it farther back and tearing large chunks of its torso away. Black filaments sprayed out and across the room like a line drawing representation of blood splatter. When the last rocket hit, the monster was blown off the bulkhead and thrown down the cargo bay toward the open doors. The black and red body tumbled toward the vast swatch of stars and darkness, and Holden let himself hope. Less than a meter from the doors, it reached out one long arm and caught the edge of a crate. Holden had seen what kind of strength was in those hands, and knew it wouldn't lose its grip.
Captain, Amos was yelling in his ear. Holden, are you still with us? Here, Amos, in a little trouble.
As he spoke, the monster pulled itself up onto the crate it had caught and sat motionless. A hideous gargoyle turned suddenly to stone.
Gonna hit the override and get you, Amos said. The inner door is fucked, so we'll lose some atmo, but not too much. Okay, but do it soon. Holden said, I'm pinned. I need you to cut the mags on this crate.
A moment later, the airlock door opened in a puff of atmosphere. Amos started to step out into the bay when the monster jumped off the crate it was sitting on, grabbed the heavy plastic container with one hand and the bulkhead with the other, and threw the container at him. It slammed into the bulkhead hard enough that Holden felt the vibration through his suit. It missed taking Amos's head off by centimeters. The big mechanic fell back with a curse, and the airlock doors shot closed again.
Sorry, Amos said. Panicked. Let me get this open. No, Holden yelled.
Stop opening the damn door. I'm trapped behind two goddamn crates now, and one of these times the door is going to cut my cable. I really don't want to be stuck in here without a radio.
With the airlock closed, the monster moved back over to the bulkhead next to the engine room and curled up into a ball again. The tissue in the gaping wounds caused by Holden's gun pulsed wetly.
I can see it, Cap, Alex said. If I stomp on the gas, I think I can knock it right out those doors.
No, Naomi and Amos said at almost the same time. No, Naomi repeated. Look where Holden is under those crates. If we go high G, it'll break every bone in his body, even if he somehow isn't thrown out the door, too.
Yeah, she's right, Amos said. That plan'll kill the captain. It's off the table.
Holden listened for a few moments to his crew argue about how to keep him alive, and watched the creature snuggle itself up the bulkhead and seem to go back to sleep.
Well, Holden said, breaking into their discussion, a high G burn would almost certainly break me into tiny pieces right now, but that doesn't necessarily take it off the table.
The new words that came over the channel seemed like a thing from another world. Holden didn't even recognize the botanist's voice at first.
Well, Prax said, that's interesting.
Chapter 27 Prax. When Eros died, everyone watched. The station had been designed as a scientific data extraction engine, and every change, death, and metamorphosis had been captured, recorded, and streamed out to the system. What the governments of Mars and Earth had tried to suppress had leaked out in the weeks and months that followed. How people viewed it had more to do with who they were than the actual footage. To some people, it had been news. For others, evidence. For more than Prax liked to think, it had been an entertainment of terrible decadence, a Busby Berkeley snuff flick. Prax had watched it too, as had everyone on his team. For him, it had been a puzzle. The drive to apply the logic of conventional biology to the effects of the protomolecule had been overwhelming and, for the most part, fruitless. Individual pieces were tantalizing. The spiral curves so similar to Nautilus shell, the heat signature of the infected bodies shifting in patterns that almost matched certain hemorrhagic fevers. But nothing had come together. Certainly someone somewhere was getting the grant money to study what had happened, but Prax's work wouldn't wait for him. He turned back to his soybeans. Life had gone on. It hadn't been an obsession, just a well-known conundrum that someone else was going to have to solve. Prax hung weightless at an unused station in ops and watched the security camera feed. The creature reached out for Captain Holden, and Holden shot it and shot it and shot it. Prax watched the filamentous discharge from the creature's back. That was familiar, certainly. It had been one of the hallmarks of the Eros footage. The monster began to tumble. Morphologically, it wasn't very far off from human. One head, two arms, two legs. No autonomous structures. No hands or rib cages repurposed to some other function. Naomi at the controls gasped. It was odd, hearing it only through the actual air they shared and not through the comm channel. It seemed intimate in a way that left him a little uncomfortable. But there was something more important. His mind had a fuzzy feeling, like his head was full of cotton ticking. He recognized the sensation. He was thinking something that he wasn't yet aware of.
I'm pinned, Holden said. I need you to cut the mags on this crate.
The creature was at the far end of the cargo bay. As Amos went in, it braced itself with one hand, throwing a large crate with the other.
Even in the poor quality feed, Prax could see its massive trapezius and deltoids, the muscles enlarged to a freakish degree. And yet, not particularly relocated. So the protomolecule was working under constraints. Whatever the creature was, it wasn't doing what the Eros samples had done. The thing in the cargo bay was unquestionably the same technology, but harnessed for some different application. The cotton ticking shifted.
No! Stop opening the damn door! I'm trapped behind two goddamn crates now!
The creature moved back to the bulkhead, near where it had first been at rest. It huddled there, the wounds in its body pulsing visibly. But it hadn't settled there. With the engines offline, there wasn't even a trace of gravity to pull it back in place. If it was comfortable there, there had to be a reason.
No, Naomi said. Her hands were on the support rings by the controls. Her face had an ashy color. No, look where Holden is under those crates. If we go high G, it'll break every bone in his body, even if he somehow isn't thrown out the door too.
Yeah, she's right, Amos said. He sounded tired. Maybe that was how he expressed sorrow. That plan'll kill the captain. It's off the table.
Well, a high G burn would almost certainly break me into tiny pieces right now, but that doesn't necessarily take it off the table.
On the bulkhead, the creature moved. It wasn't much, but it was there. Prax zoomed in on it as best he could. One massive clawed hand, clawed but still with four fingers and a thumb, braced it, and the other tore at the bulkhead. The first layer was fabric and insulation, and it came off in rubbery strips. Once it was gone, the creature attacked the armored steel underneath. Tiny curls of metal floated in the vacuum beside it, catching the light like little stars. Now, why was it doing that? If it was trying to do structural damage, there was any number of better ways. Or maybe it was trying to tunnel through the bulkhead, trying to reach something, following some signal. The cotton ticking disappeared, resolving into the image of a pale, new root springing from a seed. He felt himself smile. Well, that's interesting.
What is, Doc?
Amos asked. Prax realized he must have spoken aloud. Prax said, trying to gather the words that would explain what he'd seen. It's trying to move up a radiation gradient. I mean, the version of the protomolecule that was loose on Eros fed off radiation energy. And so I guess it makes sense that this one would too.
This one? Alex asked. What one?
This version. I mean, this one's obviously been engineered to repress most of the changes. It's hardly changed the host body at all. There have to be novel constraints on it, but it still seems to need a source of radiation.
Why, Doc? Amos asked.
He was trying to be patient.
Why do we think it needs radiation?
Oh, Prax said, because we shut down the drive. And so the reactor is running at maintenance level. And now, it's trying to dig through to the core.
There was a pause, and then Alex said something obscene.
Okay, Holden said. There's no choice. Alex, you need to get that thing out of here before it gets through the bulkhead. We don't have time to build a new plan.
Captain, Alex said. Jim, I'll be in 1 second after it's gone. Amos said, if you aren't there, it's been an honor serving with you, Cap.
Prax waved his hands, as if the gesture could get their attention. The movement sent him looping slowly through the operations deck.
Wait, no, that is the new plan, he said. It's moving up a radiation gradient. It's like a route heading toward water.
Naomi had turned to look at him as he spun. She seemed to spin, and Prax's brain reset to feeling that she was below him, spiraling away. He closed his eyes.
"You're going to have to walk us through this," Holden said. "Quickly. How can we control it?"
"Change the gradient," Prax said. "How long would it take to put together a container with some unshielded radioisotopes?"